This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world.
Well, today we have a guest on Dreamland who has been on with us off and on since 2010, but has not been on since 2017, which amazed me because Rich Dolan is so present in this field and such a major contributor. You listen to him on his own terrific show, or you listen to him on other shows, and you think, well, wait a minute, don't I have him? Haven't I had him on my show? Surely in the past 6 months or year, but I hadn't. And so here he is again, Richard Dolan, and I'm very glad you can be with us. He is one of the leading thinkers in the UFO subject, starting with UFOs and the national security state, which we interviewed him about in 2010. He offers original analysis. He is really is an absolute original and a highly skilled researcher. And he has got a new book out called The Alien Agendas, Speculative Analysis of Those Visiting Earth. We're going to be talking about a little later. So much has happened recently and so much is happening that I thought we would start out by talking about what we've been doing recently. We were on involved in a documentary together with Linda Moulton Howe and William Henry and a number of others, which presumably will be starting to appear in September, October. We were at the Making Contact conference together. We both had presentations, and we were on a panel together with Eric Weinstein, Mark Sims, and some others. Eric Weinstein is a mathematician who just recently sort of changed his stripes from being a UFO skeptic to being sort of interested. And I say sort of interested because I feel like, as I am also meeting the people who are just getting into this from a really a different level in the culture. In other words, this man Eric Weinstein is a mathematician and not at all the sort of person who you would think would be accepting this possibility. And he's having some trouble doing it, I think. And I think his problems are going to be reflected more and more in the wider community. For example, Richard, what do you think about, not Eric in particular, but when people at his level, scientists, mathematicians, intellectuals in general, come up against the ultra high strangeness that we live with every day? What happens?
Yeah, the thing that it's very easy for even brilliant people to forget or not to know is what a steep learning curve the entire phenomenon of UFOs and extraterrestrials or whoever these visitors or others are. Like, that's a steep, steep learning curve. And I remember my own experience back in the 1990s. I got into this quite a bit later than you did, Whitley. About 10 years later, actually. And I had a very naive, fond idea that once I became interested in this subject, I would need 2 or 3 months to figure it out and then move on.
All right.
And that it doesn't work like that. The UFO subject, I liken it to to something like a Zen master living in a deep cave up in a mountain. And when you go to visit a master like that, what you don't do is walk in there and demand to know everything all at once. It doesn't work like that. It's a long, long process. And actually the UFO subject is such a Zen master. It's a teacher. And the way to learn is by being humble before the phenomenon, because it is, as you just said, it's much stranger than we tend to realize. And the highly educated folks, I think in a lot of ways they have additional problems, because you go through your life, you develop your worldview, you have social status in connection with that worldview. And, you know, we all like to think that we can separate our world of ideas from the larger social situation we find ourselves in. I don't think that's really easy to do. There's so much pressure in the academic and in the established intellectual world to regard UFOs as a silly subject. So there's a real hesitancy that I think very ultra well-educated people will often have when they confront the UFO subject. And, you know, with respect to Eric Weinstein, who's obviously a brilliant man, but I, like you, when we did our panel with him, I just felt that he was very frustrated by the subject in many ways. But I think ultimately the frustration stemmed from, you know, him, like all of us in the beginning, wanting to keep the UFO subject in a nice little box that makes sense.
Right.
And it just doesn't.
It doesn't make sense. And in fact, the closer you get to it, the less sense it makes. And the more certain you become that it's somehow real, the less clear it becomes as to what that how means.
And I'll add one other thing here. Whatever the reality is, and you think about this all the time, and so do I, like, what is the actual boots on the ground reality of this phenomenon? In other words, who are we dealing with? What are their agendas? And how is that relating to our society at large? These are very deep questions. And whatever the truth is, this is something that as a society, we haven't even started to scratch the surface. You know, we've talked about a greater openness in our public discussion of UFOs since 2017. Yes, that's true. But we're at the most baby steps of all. We're at the point where we now finally have an admission. Well, there's something out there and we don't know what it is. But my God, like, the actual reality is so vastly deeper than that. And that includes what I've said for years is a cover up of the deepest levels. And that says nothing about the nature of these other beings. And those are things, when someone is starting into this field, it takes time to graduate to those types of questions and really deal with them in a meaningful way. And I think so, that frustration that we saw with Eric Weinstein, I think it was reflective of that reality.
Yeah, I do too. And I think also that the shambolic nature of the community and what it has to offer in terms of explanations and even research is going to be very difficult for them to understand, because what you basically have here are hundreds of people, many of them really skilled. Most of them have learned those skills on the fly in the process of exploring these mysteries. But what you don't have is anything that reflects the established routines of science in the academy, with very, very few exceptions. And so the result of this is that, and then you have this apparently large hidden world, which you and I know enough about to know is in fact large and is in fact hidden. But then when these people asked, well, how can I meet somebody who's connected with this world? All we have to offer are people like Jacques Vallée and Hal Puthoff, who are sort of connected with it, but they're not deep insiders. And,
right.
I wouldn't say that even if I had such information about such people, I would not be willing to share it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
They're behind a very serious wall of security.
His again, with Weinstein, his biggest criticism, as I saw it anyway, during our panel with him, which was for 2 hours, was it wasn't really even directed against the phenomenon itself. I thought it was more like, none of the way the government is handling this makes sense. They don't have their best and brightest looking at this. I know who the best and brightest are, and none of them, to my knowledge, are involved in this. So we need our smartest people to look into this. Okay, fine. We certainly would all benefit from having a much broader range of brilliant people studying this. I think we can all agree. I said one thing to him, and I wish I had said a second thing. What I said in response was, well, that is probably true, but, you know, I think security is probably more important to these people running the program, even than figuring it out scientifically. I think this is at least possible. The other thing I should have mentioned, I wish I had thought of it at the time, was I was going to say, well, probably some of the people you know might be in the program, but there's no way they could ever tell you. Never.
No.
When you're involved in studying this phenomenon in the special access program in any capacity, you are not allowed to talk about it at all. We all know this. And even a no comment is not permissible. You've got to actively deny. That's the way these programs work.
That's what's so important to understand, folks. They are legally required to lie in order to cover things up.
Yeah. And I didn't think to say that. I wish I had.
What?
I didn't think to say that in the moment when we were doing it. I wish I had thought of it.
And you wish you had. Yeah, that's right. Because it has to be remembered. And some of these people really are read in, like Hal Pudoff. It's probably read in a lot of ways. And you have to really know Hal well in order to even have a meaningful conversation with him. And then you can't know for certain where you stand because of that requirement.
I've known him for a little over 20 years. Oh, by the way, I want to remind you, you actually were the first person ever to interview me. And it was in October of 2000.
On Dreamland in October.
That's right.
Of 2000.
Yeah, you did.
Wow.
And,
I wish I had those old shows, but Clear Channel didn't keep them.
I have a copy of that interview. I found it. I had it saved. I can get it to you.
Get it to me if you can.
It was a lot of fun. I was nervous as hell. I can tell you that. I was terrified.
Probably
you were great.
Was too.
You were wonderful. But as far as with Hal Pudoff, I've known him that long also. And, you know, I like to think that I have a good relationship with him. We respect each other. We've had some personal conversations from time to time. And we've talked off the record on a number of things, but my goodness, he is famous for playing his cards very close to his chest. He doesn't give up anything that he does not want to give up. And I have at times tried to pry every little tidbit out, and I get what he's willing to give me, and that's it. Nothing more.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, I knew other people in the, my Uncle Mickey died with his secrets. I think the more I delve into my own past, I'm pretty sure my father was involved in some way. He certainly died with his secrets.
It's incredible.
General Exon died with most of his secrets, although he was much more forthcoming than the others until he slipped up and talked to people who then published his stuff, and then he was silenced. So, you know, the reason for all of this secrecy is very complex, and I want to delve into your ideas about it, because I know that we always look at the government and its decisions, and we need it to disclose to us. But what if there's another locomotion back there, someone in the visitor level of things that's controlling this? How do you respond to that thought?
Well, I've been thinking more and more and more about this as the years go by. To what extent is there control? And the first thing I would say is that it would be irresponsible to rule it out. And secondly, I think it's an entire possibility. But and I'd like to return to that. But I would just say, on the purely human scale of it, in terms of the birth of the secrecy of UFOs, one thing that I don't think any of us have really determined for sure is when did the first modern government really become aware of this? You know, you've got, I was just, you know, become aware of the research of Roberto Pinotti in Italy on the very possible UFO crash in 1933 in Italy. And I don't think that's a bad case at all. I think it's entirely possible. In the United States, we've got at least a reasonable case for the 1941 event at Cape Girardeau in Missouri, which, as years go by, I think is a probable UFO crash event as well. So that's many years before Roswell. But however we want to look at it, at some point during the 1940s, the United States government became aware of this. And I've often tried to put myself in the position of whether it's Harry Truman or even FDR, like how would a president respond to the news from his military? Like if it's a crash retrieval, so the military, from what we know of the Cape Girardeau event, we don't have as much data, but U.S. military was there and did silence people. And then with Roswell, of course, we know that story much better. So let's say the president becomes aware of it from his leading military people. I mean, what would a U.S. president really do if his top general or intelligence director says, "Sir, we've recovered technology that doesn't appear to come from this civilization. And by the way, a couple of bodies that are not human." That's a heavy thing to lay on any president. And I have a hard time seeing a U.S. president just making that announcement to the world, because there's just too many variables. A, you don't know who these beings are, friend or foe. Like, you want to get your facts straight. B, you've got technology and you have geopolitical enemies out there, or adversaries. Do you want the world to know that you've got this incredible technology? In 1947, as I've often said, the U.S. wasn't even willing to share atomic technology with the world. I can't imagine how in God's name they would want to share something as exotic as alien tech. So there would be a lot of genuine reasons, understandable reasons anyway, to initiate at least a provisional secrecy. You know, president might say to his team, "We got to get this together. We have to figure out what's going on. And who are these guys and what's their capabilities? What are they doing here?" And meanwhile, you have to control the media. You got to keep them compliant. You are going to be the guard dog in the academic world. We have to maintain and manage the conversation. I think that would be paramount. So I think that's how the secrecy starts. And then, of course, if there's any technology, you've got to get that to the right people to study it. You can get the lawyers involved. Like, who owns the tech if the Army gets it to Lockheed? Have to figure out all these things. And so you've got a network and structure of secrecy that's developed right away. And it could very well be, and I don't know, but the original decision for secrecy might have been provisional, might have been, we'll revisit this in 5 years and decide what we want to do. But I think what happens with a secret like this is it's just, there's never a good time to reveal it. It's always something you want to kick that can down the road. And next thing you know, 75 years go by and here we are. We've got an entire institutional structure of secrecy and lies that have done tremendous damage to our political institutions, for one. And I think psychological damage as well to our society. You know, when you have got people unable, you know, someone who has an encounter, whether it's with an actual being or even a dramatic UFO encounter, it's usually the most intense experience of their life. And who do they have to talk about it with? Basically no one, because there's a culture of secrecy and ridicule that's in place. And so it's not a healthy way to deal with this. You know, we're all atomized in the process. So it becomes a very unhealthy thing. But I think that's how the secrecy started, with this need, perceived need to get on top of this. And the other thing that I've wondered, and I've heard a number of other people make this argument too, I'm not the only one, but that implicit in any genuine UFO disclosure, I think ultimately would probably be a transition in our energy paradigm. I just think even a 10-year-old kid looking at an object that can instantly accelerate or zigzag or whatever, it's probably realizes it's not using gasoline to go from here to there. It's got to be a different source of energy. And if the world is apprised of this, if people are told about this, that means you've got a lot of brilliant scientists now who realize there is a post-petroleum energy solution. I think half the battle in getting to a breakthrough is just realizing that it's even possible. And so I think that would very likely spur energy research and maybe even leaks that might give some indications of a post-petroleum world. That might be great for a lot of us, but it would be a highly disruptive thing, particularly for U.S. strength and policy worldwide. U.S., especially since the 70s, it lives on what's called the petroleum dollar, controlling oil in the Middle East, forcing other nations to use the dollar as their method of transaction. And, you know, you lose petroleum as the main source of energy, that just throws everything to hell there. So there's a lot of reasons that you can see the structure of power thinking, we're going to hold on to this one. And I think as years go by, they're just going to hold on to it tighter than ever. I don't, by the way, think that we're in a true disclosure era. I think that there's a tremendous force of secrecy that still remains.
I agree with you entirely. And free Dreamlanders, it's time to take a little break. Enjoy these commercials. And above all, do what we say. We'll be right back. We're talking to Richard Dolan, his website, richarddolanmembers.com, where you can get all kinds of great stuff, such as complete access to his podcast. He operates in the same extremely annoying system I do, which is you don't get everything unless you pay. There's an awful lot there of value. And as you can hear from what Richard is saying, his opinions and thoughts are valuable. He's a highly literate, capable intellectual who has, thank God, taken an interest in this field. And there's not all that many of them around. A lot of people in the field are perhaps less careful than Richard, or unless thoughtful in some ways. But with Richard, you can always count on that careful, thoughtful approach. And he also has a tendency to break stories every once in a while before anyone else, which is a lot.
Every now and then, not too often, but once in a while.
It has happened before. So don't miss RichardDolanMembers.com and the alien agendas, which we're going to be talking about in just a minute. Now, we brushed up on the idea that there could be another level of control. And being, well, like, I'll give you an example of why that concerns me so much. Yesterday, the day after the Making Contact conference, is one of the strangest days I've had in a long time. Now, I can't tell you why. I can only tell you that apparently, I had, during the course of the day, at least two significant missing time experiences in broad daylight. Now, I've had those before. Recently, there have been quite a few. And folks, if you've never heard of missing time, it is a period of time that simply doesn't exist for you. So the result was, it was 9:30 yesterday morning. Then it was noon. Then I had my lunch and did the Zoom meeting and a couple of other things. And then it was 7:15. End of day.
Wow.
So what was going on? I think that somebody wanted to know everything I had to offer about that conference, because I think the conference was important to them. But to what degree are we involved? Because if it had been two 10-minute missing time experiences in which I had perhaps been given suggestions about what I was to do and think and talk, I wouldn't have even known it. How much of that could be going on in this world? In other words, there could be a penetration at a level that we don't expect at all. And maybe someone is behind the scenes is in much more control of what the insiders think and do than they themselves realize.
My goodness. I hate that thought, but
me too.
In your case, I mean, you had several hours of missing time, not even 10 minute slots. That's quite substantial. It reminds me of that movie, The Adjustment Bureau, you know, where you got these people going in behind the scenes and moving.
Right.
I've often entertained these ideas as well. Like, are we just characters like in a video game, and someone says, all right, I've got Strieber for the next 5 years. I'm going to manage him. You take Dolan and you take this person, and we'll move them around the board the way we want to. Like, I'm hoping that's not the case. Usually I don't think it is, but sometimes I have wondered. The thing is with UFOs, again, that to me, that was my gateway into the world of the weird. It could have been any number of other things, I suppose. But to your point about control, one of the things that I have become very interested in, and I know you must be, because I recall your many years ago when you wrote that your book, The Key, which actually you and I talked about before you published it. You had a very human man appear at your hotel and gave you one hell of a download of information. My goodness. But there are so many accounts that I have received over the years as well, and others that I've just read and researched, of entirely human-looking individuals that seem to be operating on another level.
Well, we're going to we're sort of leading now into alien agendas, folks, because there's a lot of this material that I was going to get to, and we've gotten to it. So let's go. That's great. Just keep right on.
Well, yeah. So thank you. And by the way, thank you for that nice plug of my website. I appreciate that.
Sure thing.
I resisted this whole line of looking at human looking aliens for the longest time, because, you know, I realized when I started years ago, I wanted all the aliens to behave into like one typology. Gray aliens. That's all they were supposed to be. I just thought anything more than that is confusing. I mean, I don't think that I explicitly told myself you're not going to look at anything else, but I do think at a subconscious level, I wanted to operate like that. So I had a tendency, especially in the earlier years, to, not pay as much attention to accounts of totally human looking beings, or I didn't try to think it through. Like, what did that mean? What did that mean?
Yeah, I was sort of put off by the whole 1950, mid-50s Venusians, beautiful Venusians thing. Maybe shouldn't have been.
I think that was it with me too, maybe. Yeah, I think so.
Go ahead.
So I'd had this bias against it, I suppose. But the problem was, when you just get so many accounts. My God, I remember talking with Linda Moulton Howe years ago. She personally, I don't know if she's mentioned this above, she's had encounters with very like bizarre human looking beings who just do not seem right.
So have I. I have them all the time.
Yeah, yeah. You
have lots of them.
Tim Good talked about one such encounter with this kind of a telepathic being. I've spoken with a number of other witnesses who told me of these super gorgeous blonde male-female couples dressed in beautiful blue clothing who got inside their heads. One was a 15-year-old girl in church back in 1965 in Pennsylvania, and she told me in front of her in this tiny little town where she grew up, where everyone knew everyone, especially in church, this couple that no one had ever seen before, supermodel quality in the most amazing blue clothing. So they're sitting in front of this 15-year-old girl. She was 60 now when she told me the story. She was amazed by them. She said, "My God, like, they're movie stars. No one's looking at them. Why is no one looking at them?" And she said to me, and that's when I heard them in my mind. And what she heard was one apparently thinking to the other something like, "Well, we appear to be fitting in pretty well here." And then she heard the other one think back, "Yes, except for the girl behind us who can hear us." And after that, they shut it down. She couldn't hear anything else. This was a Catholic mass. When that ended, they bolted out of the church. And she, this is almost hilarious, she decides to chase after them. And her mother, oblivious, is like, "Get back here, young lady." But so she goes through the crowd. She's chasing this couple. And she's at the front of the church. She sees them. They're across the parking lot. They've gone over this hill. And she goes after them. And they're now down in this grassy area, walking toward a wooded area, and she starts down the hill and then stopped because she saw a third person. She said, "Remember Lurch from the Addams Family? He looked just like that guy." So very tall, like a man in black suit, black hat, intimidated her, frightened her. So she didn't go any further. And this couple walked by him into the woods. He turned around and followed them into the woods, and that was her whole story. I got a similar story about these blonde supermodel types from a retired colonel, PhD, with his wife. They both told me the story. They were in a Las Vegas casino with a friend of theirs. And I'll make it short, but basically they encountered a similar type of blonde couple that they were absolutely, he heard them in his mind. Same type of thing. And they went off, and that was the end of them. I've encountered a few other of these types of stories directly. And so my point is simply, I've had to recognize there are people who look just like us, but they're not like us. Now, I don't know what they are, but when I wrote the Alien Agendas a year ago, the reason I wanted to approach that book is it was a different kind of a exploration for me. I decided I've been studying the subject long enough, and I do tend to be very conservative. I try to be anyway with my conclusions, but I thought I'd like to decide for myself what I personally believe is going on. So who are these other beings? So for that end, I wanted to go through the long history of apparent encounters. Let's put it that way. And when you go back through the centuries, it's not like you're reading a MUFON report. There's no investigators. You just get stories. But some of them are interesting. Some of them seemed credible enough to me that I included them. And my general conclusion was that human-looking operatives have been doing a low-level monitoring of us for millennia, at least for many, many centuries, and I think millennia. I even wondered if we were genetically modified 40, 45,000 years ago, and I actually put that idea out there.
Yeah, but that's one of the most interesting parts of the book. And if you want to digress for a moment, let's talk about that.
By all means.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I have a friend who she's deceased. She was a PhD, taught at two universities here in Rochester, New York. She taught at the University of Rochester and Rochester Institute of Technology. They're both very fine schools. Her name was Colleen Clemens. Colleen was a really extraordinary lady. I cared very much for her. And she had a couple of areas where she studied a lot, where she was good. But her interest toward the end of her life was in understanding potential genetic modifications of the human species about 45,000 years ago. And she got into research. Now, she died in 2008 or 2009, 2010. But anyway, her last book was in 08. And she got into research that talked about an allele that is a part of our genomic structure known as the microcephalin gene. And there's a particular variation that we now have. It's called an allele. Alleles are just variations. That is very significant for human brain development, brain growth. And we only receive this. We don't really have an exact time frame as to when we got it. It's a kind of a guesstimate. You know, I mean, generally speaking, it's around 40,000 years ago. And the thing about this gene, all the geneticists apparently are agreed, it could only have come from outside our species. Now, I don't know why they say this, but this is what they all seem to agree on. So
in other words, it could have come from the Neanderthals or the Denisovians?
Well, that would be the leading candidate, yes. Now, when she wrote that book, that was just before we learned about the Denisovans. Yeah. So she wasn't including them. They're closely related to Neanderthals, however. But what she did say is that if we were going to interbreed, then we want to be able to find that genetic evidence in the Neanderthals. They were the leading candidate. And at the time of her writing, there was no evidence whatsoever that the Neanderthals had this gene. Before we fast forward, her conclusion, provisional conclusion, was she said, look, if we can't find this gene in the Neanderthal structure, in their genomic structure, then we have to ask a hard question of who's the daddy here. And if there are no other candidates, then maybe we want to look elsewhere. And the other thing that she studied was the history of human mythology. And she was really quite good with that, actually. I learned in talking with her, and she wrote about this. Her long story short, her analysis pointed that in what she believed is the origins of some of the earliest human mythological stories of sky gods, as well as the gene structure, that she looked at basically Central Asia as the place where this interbreeding began. There are certain sky god stories that you get in the Mongol culture that we don't know how old they are because we didn't have writing, but they appear to be some of our earliest sky god stories. And her hypothesis was that a lot of these sky god stories had originated from there. We do know that in terms of the microcephalin gene that humanity has, not all human beings have it, but it radiates out from Mongolia. and the Yakutsk region in Russia. So you've got, that's like 99-100% of the people, and then it moves out from there to a lesser amount. So fast forward more than a decade, and I'm thinking about wanting to figure out what do I think about the alien presence here. And however it was, I just remembered Colleen's work. So the first thing I wanted to do was find out, well, did we discover if the Neanderthals or now the Denisovans have this gene? And I went through all the academic scientific papers I could find on it. And the answer is no, they do not have it. And it's not for lack of trying, because the people studying this, they are well aware. We've got the gene and they don't. And so you can read in these papers, the researchers wanted desperately to find the microcephalin gene in the Neanderthals. And it just doesn't look like it's there, Whitley. It just doesn't. The Denisovans, we have much less genetic evidence for them, unfortunately. But we do know they are very closely related to the Neanderthals. And it doesn't look, frankly, like they are the source either. So if they're not the source, I just carried on Colleen's argument. And I thought, is it possible? You know, you can envision humanity. I'm a very avid student of human prehistory. I actually am deeply engaged in that, and I love studying it. And if you were to imagine an extraterrestrial species or some other species observing humans, say 45, 50,000 years ago, you could see them thinking, they are very close. These are very clever beings, these humans. Let's do a little something for them. Let's tweak them a little bit. And you know, the theory is, were we genetically enhanced by them? And if that's the case, just as Charles Fort 100 years ago wondered, are we someone's project? Are we property? Or are we just someone's beneficent, benign project? I don't know. But anyway, that's where I started. And what I would say after that is that over the many centuries, there have been at least a few decent stories, accounts of people who have encountered what certainly appear to be beings. They look like us, but they don't seem to be from where we are. And so I think that we've been in a low-level monitoring process. I'll just finish my thought here. What I also believe is that if I incorporated a theory into this book, and I call it the fourth stage of humanity, to me, this actually, to my satisfaction, explains why I think other beings are here. So we've gone through three full stages of human development. In my view, there's only three ways that we've ever lived: for hundreds of thousands of years as hunter-gatherers, for most of our time, frankly. And then a little less than 10,000 years ago, we developed agriculture and towns and cities and writing and the wheel and metallurgy, like all the things that give us civilization, everything from ancient Egypt to the Italian Renaissance. And then that's stage two. So then stage three is science and industry, which we just developed a few centuries ago. And that transformed us yet again. And now I think we're moving to a fourth stage where it's qualitatively going to be different. And maybe we can call it the transhuman stage. That might be the best word for it. But it's a combination of more than just genetic manipulation. It's complete data analysis and data hoovering, data vacuuming of the entire world, and 5G and artificial intelligence and complete monitoring and surveillance, what I sometimes think of as turning humanity into a big giant anthill. And I think we're moving toward that. And I think that's what's getting everyone's attention out beyond our community, because I think although it will probably diminish our individual power and sovereignty, it will make us collectively very, very powerful, very powerful. So, and I think it's at that point, sometime in the last century, when that transition was clearly would be visible to someone else, that we started getting other visitors, other beings, the grays or the mantids or insectoids, I think would be first front row center of those visiting groups, maybe reptilian beings as well. So I think we started getting the attention of other groups at that time.
Well, you know, in the grays, I haven't heard too much about other forms being interested in abduction and in particular the removal of sexual material and so forth. When I had that experience, it was with the grays and also these dark blue troll-like figures, which I've come to suspect have much more to do with us than it seems obvious. I'm not sure they're aliens at all. I think they might be from here also, but not the Greys. I don't think the Greys are from here.
I tend to agree with you. And I'll just add, I think the human looking contingent, let's say, my speculation, and it's only a speculation, could be an alien species might have taken their own supply of native humans and used them as their avatars or as their workforce to do the monitoring. It would be a lot more rational, first of all, make more sense. But I think that over time, would it be possible that such a human group would be so different from us, like culturally and also through genetic modifications, possibly, we might have very little in common with them in certain ways.
Well, you know, that seems like a logical, so it's so logical that you'd think it almost must have happened. And when you look at this gene and you look back 40,000 years, and when I was reading your book, I was also aware of another book called The Cycle of Cosmic Catastrophes, which is about something primarily about something that happened 12,000 years ago that instituted the Younger Dryas and the whole upheaval that led to the essentially the collapse of the entire ecosystem, the extinction of the mammoths and the disappearance of essentially all human life in North America, etc. That's a well-known geologic fact, and it's been extensively studied on many different levels, geology, paleontology, archaeology, etc. But he points out in the book that about 40,000 years ago, there was a supernova that irradiated a strip of the Earth, which included much of Australia, and it caused the extinction of all of the large marsupials that were there at the time.
Okay.
And the reason was they couldn't hide from it. The smaller animals went into burrows and the human beings that were there hid because they saw this gigantic extra sun in the sky and they scared them and they hid in caves. But the big animals, the big massive marsupials all died out because they were irradiated with gamma radiation.
Interesting.
Now, at that time, something big was going on. And the human species probably took a tremendous hit. Probably there was a significant population decline around the world simply because of the violence of what had happened. Could it be that that was when somebody decided, well, wait a minute. This species was coming along beautifully. We need to intervene to give them enough intelligence to survive.
That's interesting. I mean,
it seems logical to me.
Yeah, it's not. That's an interesting idea. That could be true. I haven't heard that before, so I think that's quite intriguing. One thing that's definitely obvious, I think most people listening are aware, that it was about 40,000 years ago that you see a true creative explosion in among human beings.
Well, that's one of the most fascinating parts of your book. And folks, I just want to, since we're not going to take a second commercial break, I want to remind you now, go to richarddolanmembers.com and get involved. You have to be involved in this. And yes, it may take you spending money on more than one subscription, but there's nothing more important going on in the world. So do it. Get involved and listen. But go ahead.
Well, thank you, Whitley. I'll add, I have a lot, probably like you, I have a lot of free content that people can just peruse if they want. But yeah, our creativity just went parabolic at around 40,000 years ago.
Exactly.
Even among earlier humans, forget the Neanderthals who were there at the time as well, but earlier human cultures had some artwork, but it's... And I'm not trying to diminish any of it, but it's not anywhere close to the level that you start seeing with these incredible cave paintings and sculptures. And also not just art, but music, We started seeing some of the earliest musical instruments around that time, and a tremendous development. I'm not sure how much I got into this, but in tool making and tool, like the great, great creative expansion in the kinds of tools and weapons that people use to hunt and so on. Sewing and so much more. So you really start seeing a piling on of one creative development after another. So a lot of things seem to coalesce at around 40 to 45,000 years ago. And that supernova, yeah, I would be intrigued by that. And I wonder if that could be a contributor to it.
You know, when you look at that cave art, that, for example, the art at Chauvet-Pont d'Arc in France, 37,000 years old, and it is highly sophisticated. It's not just the early attempts of someone to draw. It is someone with extraordinary skill, not only in terms of art, but in their ability to place the art in such a way that it uses the natural formation in the cave to give the creatures that are being depicted substance and form. I mean, you know, they looked at the rocks and built the creature, drew the creatures around the rocks in such a way that their bodies would have three dimensions and so forth and so on. But here's the most bizarre thing. It's very dark back in those caves, but there are no indications of any, for example, any soot from torches. So how in the world did they do that?
That's a good question. You know, it's interesting. Pablo Picasso visited one of those caves and examined the art. Back in the early years, like, it was a lot easier for people to get access to those. And when he came out, he said something like, "We have gained nothing on those ancestors. Like, we invented nothing. They invented it." I think he was blown away by the quality of the artistic work and how they did it. I didn't realize the lack of soot from torch. You'd have to have torches there for light because it's pitch black otherwise.
I know. You had to have some kind of light or who knows? It's just such a mystery, but the greater mystery is I'm pretty sure about the torches comment, but I'm not certain that's true in all of the caves. I'm pretty sure it's true at Chauvet.
Interesting.
But even if it isn't, even if they did have torches, that doesn't change the extraordinary skill that was involved. And when you look at the work, you can see that it's not labor. In other words, there's no one slowly, carefully etching along. This was drawn with ease and skill by someone who was very confident in their ability. It has the look of confident art that's unmistakable.
Yeah, and you think about it, it's not like you can just take an eraser and if you make a mistake, I'd have to think that would be a difficult process. So like, it's almost like doing a fresco, you know, it goes up there and it's done. Don't screw it up. So there's like this risk involved in any kind of great art creation because you can easily screw it up. And you're so right. There's this, I hadn't thought about it, but this ease, this confidence in being able to master what they were portraying, and they did it. They nailed it.
They did it. They nailed it. Now, free Dreamlanders, I've got some very bad news for you and good news basically for nobody. You have to leave now. And I want you to subscribe to my show. I ask you every week, and about, I think, a little under 2% of you actually do subscribe. And I'm grateful for that 2%, believe me, because the rest of you wouldn't be here either if it wasn't for them. So subscribe to unknowncountry.com. Go to Richard Dolan membership, members.com. find and do the same thing you do on my website, dig around for all the free stuff, but then take another step. Get into this. It's not expensive. Richard's is $7 a month. Mine's $5 a month. These things aren't costly, but they are so valuable, because there will come a time when Richard and I are both bones in the ground, and probably most of you are too, when these websites are going to be in historical archives, assuming we still exist, which who knows whether that will be the truth or not. But they're important. They're valuable. So respect that, please, and help us. Free Dreamlanders, subscribers, we're just going to keep on keeping on. So, Richard, why now for the UFO? We have some kind of, and I think it's very difficult to conclude now that we know they are here in some way, that these mysterious things like this gene that sort of appears out of nowhere in our distant past, it's hard to think that somebody hasn't been here for a long time. But then, after World War II, there is a sudden upsurge in UFO sightings. There is a strange event that happens at the Trinity site where Jacques Vallée and Paola Harris have written about, apparently a crash there. There may have been a crash in Italy in the 30s, as you pointed out earlier. Then there's the Roswell incident. And then the UFO flyover that took place in Washington in 1952, and the spectacular series of apparently related events that Frank Ficino chronicles in his book, Shoot 'Em Down. All of that starts to happen. The UFO age begins. Why did it? And I'm asking what I regard to be probably one of the very best people in the world to answer that question. So don't say you don't know.
Well, I've had my theory.
That's what we want to hear.
Yeah. I actually think that when we go back through some of the 20th century reports of these objects, and sometimes encounters with beings, that there actually was a bit of a crescendo even before the Second World War, at least compared with prior centuries. It's hard to know how accurate all of those claims are, but there's quite a few of them, and it does lead me to think that there was an increasing presence of a phenomenon even during the 1920s and especially the 30s. Most of those encounters were seemed to be a totally human looking beings. But then it's true during the Second World War and in the immediate aftermath, I mean, that's when the kind of the UFO explosion happened. I mean, if you look at it from an outsider's point of view, if they're able to observe us, they could obviously see that the Second World War was a massive global conflagration with tremendous new technologies. I mean, culminating in the atomic bomb, but not even just the A-bomb. There was a development of radar and the development of all kinds of other electronics advances, and also advances in computing technology, even during the 1940s. I think it would be very evident for any observing species to think these human beings right now are on the cusp of jumping into our world. And I think particularly with nuclear power and controlling the atom. And I think that's supported by the fact that when you look at so many of the early 1940s and 50s encounters, there's so many that have a clear interest in nuclear technology, whether yes. The United States or Oak Ridge or Los Alamos or the Hanford plant in Washington or in the Belgium uranium mine document we have from 1952. And also the Soviets, the Russians had a number of their
nuclear, experienced intrusions too.
Totally. Yes. So I think there's a definite nuclear interest that these beings have. I don't think there's any question about it. And it goes way beyond statistical randomness. In fact, there was a UFO researcher who did a statistical analysis of that. His name is Donald Johnson. He was with CUFOS for many years. He's a PhD statistician, and he did this study and said there's way beyond statistical chance that we've all of these nuclear encounters. So I think there's an interest in that. And I just believe that we triggered a much greater interest by other beings. Now, the great question is why do they just not announce themselves to us? And I'm not sure if that was a question you wanted to ask, but I'll just say.
I think it's one of the absolutely central questions.
I agree. And here I'm speculating again. But one reality is they're probably not like us in any way psychologically. I mean, I actually think that these grays are not a naturally occurring biological organism. I mean, I think they are biological, but I don't think they're naturally occurring.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think we can determine a lot about that actually from the Chilbolton crop formation, which indicates that their DNA, that they have a mix of carbon and silicon in their bodies.
Oh, yes,
that
yes.
Means that's a good they point. Are at least partly artificial, it must.
I think that they are partly artificial, and I think that they're designed, very possibly designed to interact with us here on this planet. They may just be a completely, a one-off, for all I know, to deal with us here. And maybe with some human DNA so that they can function and deal with the microbes and who knows with what else that's here on Earth. But I don't think that they're...
When you're face-to-face with one,
yes.
In the larger ones, like in the 5-foot-tall range, it feels like you're with a really strange-looking person. It doesn't have an alien feel to it at all.
That's interesting. You also said, actually, that they gave you the feeling of almost being psychologically naked, if I recall that, just of having no defense. Did I remember that correctly?
Yeah, because when I would think that, my God, this woman is ugly. She would reel and make a high-pitched shrieking noise of anguish. It was
horrible. That you thought she was ugly?
Yeah, I mean, and I because she was. I mean, let's face it, she was. And there,
a face only her mother could love, if she has a mother.
Well, I don't know if I can't imagine that, but.
Well, I was wondering, because if they are artificial in any degree, we humans, we're born from a mother. We nurse at our mother's breast. We have it's a bonding experience that we have with our mothers, if we're lucky, and with our fathers as well. We grow up with this feeling of love, again, if we're lucky to have that, but many of us do. And so that's how we operate psychologically. Like we're mammals, and we have a certain way of thinking and going about the world. But what if these other beings don't have that? What if they don't nurse at their mother's breast? What if they don't have families the way that we do? It doesn't mean they're worse than us, but it would mean that they might think totally differently than we do. So I wouldn't know how to expect them to have psychological reactions the way we would. And secondly, if they're operating in this intensely telepathic level, which they certainly appear to be doing, it could be just a real practical issue. Like, how do you deal with a human species? Like, it would almost be like us going off into the depths of Africa and finding a gorilla tribe and walking up to the lead gorilla there and saying, "Hi, I'd like to make diplomatic relations with your tribe." You couldn't do that.
No, you couldn't.
It wouldn't operate. And I wonder if we're at a radically different psychological place than they are. So that might be the reason. And the other reason they may not announce themselves is if they're up to something. Like if they're up to something that well, we may know, not
we're in
like.
We're in a climax of some kind on planet Earth. The climate is obviously falling apart around us. There are 8 billion of us on the planet right now. The planet can't change too much if those people are going to survive in large numbers. And if even a relatively small number of them are seriously threatened with their survival because of climate change or lack of food or hunger or whatever, they're going to go berserk. The place is going to explode.
We have an infrastructure that's very fragile, in my opinion.
And that's the other thing. The infrastructure. So I wrote a book years ago called Solar Flares, which talked about what would happen if a solar flare on the order of the one that occurred in 1850 were to occur now.
Yeah.
And it would ruin our world. It would send us back to the Dark Age.
Just we are not prepared.
And we're not prepared for it.
We would not survive a pre-electrical. Forget the computers. We'd be losing electricity potentially. We're done.
I mean, can you imagine going from where you are sitting right now to a situation where you have instantaneously no lights, no electricity, your car doesn't work, the gas pumps don't work anyway because there's no electricity to serve them. You would go back straight back to the horse and buggy age, and I'll tell you what'll happen. You're going to starve to death very quickly.
Right.
Under those circumstances. But people are noisy when they begin to starve. It gets real rough. So, I think we're kind of hanging by a thread. And
yes.
What gets me is this.
I agree with you.
If they're going to intervene and somehow give us some kind of support, now is the time. It's almost too late. And they don't.
No. No. Yeah, we want a deus ex machina. We want someone to come in and save us, and that's not happening. And in fact...
Do they want us to die? Is that it?
I wonder. Look, I actively wondered this in my book.
I know you do. That's why I brought it up.
I have a lot of interests like you. And one thing I like studying to some extent is the artificial intelligence and future tech, I guess. A lot of folks listening, I'm sure, do as well. And, I think like the world that we are creating, let me put it this way. And I suspect you're going to agree with me because of something you said on our panel the other day. We like to, sometimes we'll get this assumption, like we're so far behind these aliens. We will never catch up. We're eons behind them. We must be like insects compared with how they think of us, you know? And I don't agree with that at all, actually.
No, neither.
I didn't think, cause you said something similar to this. And that is because, I realized that progress does not just go incrementally. You know, as I was talking about this fourth stage of humanity, it goes by leaps. You know, it's a leap to go from hunting and gathering to settled agriculture. It's not just an incremental change. And it's another leap to go into science and industry. And what we're about to do is yet another leap. And I actually suspect that the leap we're about to do, like once all of that matures, which it hasn't yet. So in other words, the coalescing of strong artificial intelligence, what's called generative AI that can think for itself, in other words, along with a super advanced nanotech and super advanced CRISPR gene editing technology and super advanced 5 or 6G surveillance technology, and data gathering and minority reporting people, you know, predictive behavioral modeling. All of these are totally transforming our society in a way that we actually, and quantum computing and the list goes on. So what if we actually are going to get to a plateau that these other beings actually are at that plateau? What if there isn't a plateau beyond it? What if we're actually going to get to that plateau and maybe we'll be at a slightly lower level of that plateau than where they are, but we're going to be a basic, almost a parity, and we might be a real hassle for them. Or we might be a real prize, or the infrastructure we create might be a real prize. What if they have the ability? What if they look at Earth and they think, wow, this is an amazing planet. We're going to figure out a way to live here because we like it. What if we found out a way to create our own human body containers? And then we could control them. Look, I'm just let me go.
No, I'm laughing with you, not at you. Believe me.
We control the global financial system. We control the entire, and we can just game the system, and then we can be eating caviar on the French Riviera, and we'll depopulate the rest of these useless eaters as much as we need to. And we can just live. And by the way, we'll make ourselves live here for 1,000 years with extending our genetics, and we'll be like gods on this planet. Won't that be awesome? Drink champagne, you know, rock and roll all night, all day, and party every day, just like the song. Like, I don't know, but like, I wonder.
And then when it all falls apart, we'll just leave.
Sure, right. But they may want to stay here. And we're creating an infrastructure that allows, that would allow for any elite, human or otherwise, to have, to truly to live like gods. Like, that's what we are creating right now. Whoever's at the top.
I know some billionaires. I don't know, not that are interested in this, but one of them has been a family friend for years, and is a dear guy. And he lives in an entirely different world. I mean, he has a magnificent yacht, a fleet of airplanes, houses all over the place, servants everywhere. And it is a completely different world.
Incredible. Yeah.
And totally insulated from the outside.
Yes. Yeah, so imagine if you could, you see this beautiful planet of ours, and it's very beautiful. And you think, oh, I'd like a piece of that action. So would there be a way to worm their way into the structure? And I think looks like they may have done it. When you deal with all of these human looking actors involved. And then on top of that, like, I've gotten so many there. I can't confirm these stories. I mentioned a couple earlier, but there's quite a few others. And I've had people actually talk to me about what they believe is active infiltration by these non-humans. I mean, I'm talking economic and financial infiltration. And in fact, I recall talking with Linda about this very thing. You know, she's talked now quite a bit about her DIA connection from, I think, 1999, who told her about extraterrestrial races here. And if I'm not mistaken, when she told me the story years ago, I think this man told her they were in the IMF or the World Bank. Like, they had international financial power and leverage. I believe that is what this man said to Linda. So, you know, if you want to look at these various data points, I can't say that I know it's true, but I will say this. Like, if I were in charge of human Earth-based counterintelligence, I definitely want to be exploring that possibility. And I've got to think that there are people who are trying to explore it. But the question is, who's in charge of this show? Who's running the show that is humanity at this time? That's the question.
You know, years ago, I was briefly involved with Senate Select Intelligence Committee that was trying to worm information about this stuff out of the intelligence community. And they were using me to help them formulate questions. And one of them said to me that the greatest fear of the government and in the intelligence community is of just this that we're talking about, human form aliens, which have a hidden agenda that we can't determine the nature of.
And they said that to you. That was one of their greatest fears. Yeah.
That was one of their greatest fears. Yeah.
I remember
became scared of. You're looking at him. I mean, I'm about as least alien person I can imagine. But there you had it. I got into all kinds of trouble with them because of it, because they were scared of me.
Remember the story of the late remote viewer Ingo Swann? I was lucky. I got to spend an evening in his home. I slept over. Ingo was an extraordinary guy, very interesting man. And he actually told me directly his story of his encounter with the mysterious Mr. Axelrod, which he wrote about in one of his books called Penetration. Here's the title for you. It's a fascinating story, and I believe it. And I've talked to people who worked with Ingo. Everyone believes this story, everyone who knew Ingo. But essentially, you know, back in the 70s, back in his heyday, he wasn't just doing remote viewing work for the Stargate program through SRI for Hal Puthoff and Russell Targ. But he was already a legend because he had successfully remote viewed the planet Jupiter before our first space probe reached it. And he actually detected the presence of a planetary ring, which was not known yet. and a number of other qualities of the planet, which all turned out to be true. So that made him a legend within the intelligence world. And he would get all of these phone calls, like, to do freelance work, basically, for them. They pay him money. It was a nice gig if you can get it. So he gets a phone call from an office of an Axelrod, and he takes this assignment. He goes down to D.C., and he's met by these two guys. He calls them the twins. They're identical looking. They're very military demeanor. They don't say a word. They've got cue cards. They put him into a car. They, and their cue card apologizes for having to blindfold him, but he can't see where they're going. And he spends, he goes into this deep, 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 deep place, and the elevator door opens, and the blindfold comes off, and he meets Axelrod. And he spends a week, gets paid good money. And the first thing Axelrod says is, "I'd like you to know what you think about the moon." Ingo knew nothing about the moon, and he remote views coordinates and saw beings and structures on the moon. That started this several years on and off thing with Axelrod and these twins. Long story short, what I was left with at the end of all of this, and I'm not the only one, is that the Axelrod operation wasn't a human operation. These were human looking non-humans, and their job was to do counterintelligence on the remote viewing program to see just how good are these remote viewers. Do we have vulnerabilities? This is what I think. I personally believe that this was an operation by them. And, you know, because nothing else to me makes sense, frankly, when I look at all the factors of that story.
I would think so. And it's so logical that if there's someone here, if we went to another planet and had the capability to do this, we would certainly penetrate their cultures with
we sure would.
With professional level witnesses.
That's right.
If we could do that without being detected.
You know, I don't know what your thoughts are on the research of Dave Jacobs. I haven't really asked you about that, but I've read all of David's books very carefully. I actually.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. And I admire many things about the way his mind works on this. He's really one of the few people out there who actively tried for his entire career, actually, to think like, who are these guys? What's their agenda? What's their process? So really, in my view, trying to get inside their head to some extent. And I don't know if I agree with everything David concluded. I think that I don't. But one thing that he, of course, his research shows, and he's not the only one either here. Even the wonderful, beautiful Barbara Lamb, I think, she just has a different interpretation. But this idea of human-looking hybrids who have infiltrated our society. And in David's opinion, of course, this is nefarious. In his opinion, it's a kind of planned takeover thing. A lot of the people that he regressed, he said, talked about that these human hybrid handlers talked about this upcoming, the great change. And no one's ever got any detail about it. But David's interpretation was that, well, that's going to be when they do a formal takeover. I think, you know, maybe, but I think more likely that they could very well be somehow managing our process. I don't know if it's the human hybrids by the Greys or if it's another human contingent. I really have no idea. But I think what they are noting is that they know that we are going through the great change right now. It doesn't have to be an overt takeover. It could simply be the confluence of all of our technologies happening now, along with basically the imposition of a global totalitarian state, which is, I think, what we are having. I think that's what we're looking at now. And that is going to be our great change. And it'll probably take over several decades, you know, to implement it.
You know, where it's going to come from, I think, and let's talk about this a little bit, because I see that too. I see the globalization of control,
right,
of the species. I see it. China is like a test case where they are really the Chinese are kind of being roboticized, and in the sense that you're being constantly watched by Big Brother and graded, and your grading the degree
determines your whole life.
Yeah, the degree of access you have to the culture and the society depends on this grading.
That's right.
Now, that could creep out. in a covert way through, and it already does.
It's clearly happening here as well.
Well, yeah, because look at the situation with credit review and so forth. What are those things called? They give you a report.
Credit score?
I don't know much about it. Credit reports, they're called, where yeah. you have a credit rating and you're, yeah. you know, you're suddenly, you know, you're, if that could be manipulated by something other than the algorithm that determines your actual credit worthiness, if it could be manipulated ideologically, you don't need a system as overt as the one in China. You could have a system there in place that no one even knew existed that would affect their credit ratings and therefore their ability to function in the culture, in the society.
Well, we're developing. I used to say we're 10 to 20 years behind China's social credit system. I think we're less than 10 years behind it now. So what China has done is they've formalized it through their legal structure, their legal system. Have we moved far along that path, but mostly the enforcement of our social credit system is informally through big tech, through corporate allies of government and of the intelligence, yes. the Facebook and Google primarily, and through Google, YouTube, and Twitter, of course. So
Apple just threw their entire privacy promise out the window, and now they're going to be able to look at everybody's photographs on everything they possess that's Apple
right.
related
right.
and determine whether or not those photographs contain child pornography. Now, that sounds to me like good. I mean, but that's how it's supposed to sound. It means that they can build profiles of you, psychological profiles of you based on the photographs that you possess that are going to be extremely accurate and insightful.
All they need is a foot in the door. So when you get that, then, you know, there years ago, I read the story of how the Cross Bronx Expressway in New York City was built by a man named Robert Moses. And he was kind of an evil genius. He would always lowball the price, always. And then once they were committed, price kept going up. And once they were in, Moses knew, well, we could just, you know, you're going to do this and you're going to pay what I knew you were going to pay all along. And I think that's the way with pretty much everything. You know, you get your foot in the door. 9/11 worked the exact same way with the USA Patriot Act. That, you know, at the time we were supposed to be told, well, it's just a temporary thing to deal with the terrorists. The 9/11 legal revolution never went away. And now with COVID, I mean, my goodness, this COVID, I look at this now, the response to that, it makes 9/11 look like a dress rehearsal for what we're going through. And I didn't think 9/11 could be a dress rehearsal for anything, at least for a while. I didn't think so, but it clearly is. And what everyone thinks about masks or no masks or vaccine or no vaccine, I will say it's obvious. It should be obvious that the centralized clampdown of people's freedoms, people's ability to travel, and now really the true creation of second-class citizens in all Western nations, which is obviously happening, that's not going to go away either. The medicalization of dissent, that's not going to go away. And all of these other pernicious developments that have been happening, these are, I don't think anyone is under the illusion that they're not permanent. I think they're all going to be permanent changes. And it has to be done from their point of view. Again, this goes back to the world that we're creating through this fourth stage of humanity. One of the things that mainstream economists are terrified of is what they call the robo-pocalypse. That's the Terminator coming to take your job, not to kill you, just to take your job. And so, you know, there's serious question like that. These people are asking, what are people going to do with their lives? How are you going to make money? This is why you get universal basic income being discussed. And in a world like that, you cannot have the kind of freewheeling intellectual culture that we used to have.
No, you can't
have these independent thinkers because they're going to be too much of a problem. They're going to be too restless. they must be controlled.
Yeah.
And they must be sedated both medically, literally, and through the junk information that comes their way through a controlled medium. And that's what's happened. You basically give them bad food, bad information, and they're just incapable of thinking for themselves. And that has happened with such swiftness in the last year and a half. I've looked at this for so many years. Even before I got into UFOs, I was always interested in these issues. But I have to say, honestly, I am shocked by the speed with which this has happened in the last year and a half. I just can't believe it.
Everything seems to be speeding up. Not just that, but the whole process. And let's talk about why 2017. Why did Lou Elizondo suddenly come out with what he came out with? And why did, I mean, I understand Leslie and Ralph, Leslie Keene and Ralph Blumenthal pitched this brilliantly to the New York Times, but it took some doing.
Yes.
But why would the New York Times, after years of ignoring this and the debunkers held sway, let's put it that way,
right,
would it suddenly agree to basically change the world?
My best theory is, because TTSA, To the Stars Academy, had a press conference in October of 2017. Now, we can get into the motivations of TTSA, but in terms of the New York Times, when TTSA did that press conference, so you got Tom DeLonge up there, you got Hal Puthoff, you got Jim Semivan, you got Christopher Mellon, you got Lou Elizondo and Steve Hutchins. Yes, the Lockheed Skunk Works guy. So they were up there. It's a very impressive group of people. And they are talking about the reality of UFOs, even though they didn't use the phrase UFO, but it's obvious what they were talking about. So, and they also, you've got the former head of ATIP, Elizondo, there. So I think Leslie and Ralph realized this story is going to break one way or another. You cannot contain this anymore. So I think they wanted to do the story. Certainly don't blame them. They pitched it. And I suspect that the leadership at the New York Times, which is always hostile to UFOs, that is true. But they might have thought, yeah, we're going to get out ahead of this one and do it in such a way as to actually, I think what they did is to mitigate the damage. I actually think they did that. You know, if you go back to the first article I had on announcing the reality of ATIP, the Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program, in that first article in December 2017, they threw in these ridiculous statements by these debunkers and skeptics. Like, look, I have no personal beef against James Oberg as a human being, but he had no business being in that story. Just basically throwing cold water. And they brought in this Yale astronomer. I never even heard of her before for another skeptical tape. She had nothing relevant to say. So here you have the New York Times. I'm sure Leslie and Ralph had nothing to do with including that. There's no way. No way. I'm sure they had to do it. So you have the New York Times leadership guiding this story. That to me is the most obvious thing. So I think what their strategy was to get out ahead of it and minimize the impact, not maximize, minimize the impact. In other words, I do not believe that what we have seen thus far is an active U.S. government sponsored disclosure initiative. I just don't think so. I don't think so anymore.
If we were seeing that, the Air Force would be involved, and it's not.
Yes. And moreover, you would see, I think, a much greater media coordination. And we're definitely not seeing that. You got Tucker Carlson on Fox. He's like truly the single mainstream person who asks good questions on this subject, who actually, I wish we'd talk even more about it, but it's him. No one over it. You've got a couple of bad CNN interviews that happened on this. There's clearly no coordination.
Right.
Among the mainstream on this. So when people say, oh, this is a coordinated government effort, well, I'd like to see some evidence that that is the case. On top of that, you've had a number of Pentagon statements that really smeared Luis Elizondo a number of times, quite a few.
To the extent that he's got a lawyer. I mean, you know.
Danny Sheehan, yes, absolutely. So I don't see that this is a coordinated effort from above. What I believe is that Elizondo and the other folks who were in TTSA, they had their reasons possibly personal, maybe professional, but to open up a dialogue on UFOs. That's literally what I got when I asked Hal Puthoff. I said, look, what's the deal? And it's true. He says what he wants to say and doesn't say what he doesn't. But his whole point was, look, we want to just open up a public dialogue better than what has existed before to make it more veridical. That was what he's more truthful. I'm sure there's other reasons involved. Maybe they want a piece of the defense action pie. Maybe I wouldn't blame them if they did. Who can fault them? But what they have done, I think they are a faction of a certain number of semi insiders, not the deepest even, but they had enough clearances that they were able to make some headway and they started a conversation. But I think they also have enemies who do not want this conversation to go any further than it has.
I agree with you. And, you know, this business of insiders is, as Eric Weinstein on our panel was saying, well, you know, you give me these people, Hal Puthoff and Jacques Vallée, and they don't, you know, they're not the level that I would think would be involved. And there would be have to be people at a higher level. And I thought to my, and he brought up this brilliant physicist whose father was involved in gravity research.
Oh yes, and whose father was the most greatest genius as well. I didn't actually know who that was.
But I'm not going to say names because he didn't, and I'm not sure. Mm. I'm never sure where on my ground. Yeah. So,
his question was, why isn't he involved?
Right. And those are really very good questions. And the reason
if he's not involved,
if he's not, exactly, that's another thing. If he's not, because you know, for God's sakes, my own uncle was involved, and heavily involved all of his life, and I didn't find that out until 1988 after I had published Communion. Yeah. His kids knew, but I didn't, and I was his nephew.
The greatest mind of the 20th century, arguably, could be John von Neumann, who was just an off the charts brilliant genius.
And who was involved, I'm sure.
I think he was, yes. We have got a couple of data points putting him involved. Absolutely. There's a famous letter by Robert Sarbacher, the scientist, back in 1983, who said von Neumann was definitely involved. And you've got people investigating the Aztec UFO crash. There's actually research that puts von Neumann involved in that as well.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised. I believe that General Exon mentioned his name to me. Wow. Someone did. It may have been Robert Sarbacher. I also talked to him, or I think I did.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Well,
I'm envious.
This must have been in 87. It's a very strange business. Stanton Friedman gave me his number. I found his name.
But I'm wondering if it was earlier, Whitley, because I'm thinking Sarbacher died slightly earlier than that, and I don't recall the year offhand.
But well, I'm getting to that.
Oh, so sorry.
You know,
my apologies.
I talked to him extensively, and he asked me to write up my story. So I typed it all up, and I was still on a typewriter. So it might have even been 86 because I was, yeah, it probably was 86. I was researching Communion. And I would have gotten in touch with people like Friedman as I worked, because I was coming at this from totally cold, just like you did. And anyway, I had this extensive conversation with him about the metal and all of this stuff. Mm. And then I sent this off by overnight express by UPS Express, which was just getting started at the time. And the guy called me up from the other end and said, I can't deliver it because this man is dead. And so I don't know whether I was talking to Robert Sarbacher or someone in Langley, Virginia. I have no idea. And of course, my description of what happened to me was never returned, although he said, the UPS man said, we will return your package. It never came back.
It never got it. Yeah, that's an interesting. I think I do remember you saying that once before. I'm glad you repeated that.
Yeah, and there's some kind of date discrepancy. I think that he might have died either right around that time, and so it's conceivable. I talked to him the day before he died, but I find that hard to believe. Or I was talking to someone who was pretending to be him, which makes me wonder what Stanton thought he was up to, giving me the number in the first place.
Yeah, boy, I'd like that's interesting indeed.
Yeah, well, there you have it. I mean, we both live in interesting times. We all live in interesting times, but people who get involved in this stuff that you're involved in and I'm involved in live in a really interesting corner of interesting times.
And honestly, I think the things that we study are just absolutely fascinating. It's why I do it.
Me too.
I did. Yes, we didn't get into this because we want to argue with other people in the field, and we don't want to get into it because of other personalities. We entered this field, like hopefully most people do, because it's just fascinating. And
it sure
it's the most fascinating subject I've ever encountered in my life.
Well, exactly. I'm curious too. I want to ask you one last question before we go, and we're just about to finish here. Orbs. You have some fascinating material toward the end of the book about orbs.
Orbs?
Orbs, yeah,
oh,
orbs.
Yes, okay, yes.
Can you talk to us a little bit about your thoughts about orbs?
Yes. I forgot that I wrote about them. But I think orbs are fascinating. I think that they're, especially these orange orbs, I think that seems to be the color that I come across the most. For example, I don't know if I wrote this or not in the book, but I had a very close friend of mine locally here where I live in upstate New York. He's interested in UFOs, but he said many years ago, 1978, I think his stepdaughter was woke up at like 2 a.m. She was like 11 years old or something, like she was a kid. And she looked out the window of her bedroom and saw this glowing orange orb. And the next thing she knew, she was out in the backyard, not knowing what the heck had just happened to her. But it was like this mental connection. Somehow this orb woke her up, is the way he described it. And she had this connection. There are so many. Well, I don't want to say so many. There are many witness accounts of particularly orange orbs that clearly seem to act intelligently. And, you know, we're talking about a ball of light. This is what it looks like. This is what it seems to be. Is it just a coherent plasma ball that can act with intelligence? I don't know what it is, but it seems to be able to do that and to be able to interact with the human mind to some extent. Yeah. And so I don't know who that is or what that is, or if that's someone's technology and like an avatar for them. Is that something that the grays have or some other species has? Is it like a scouting mission, or are those things alive on their own merit? I do not know, but I'm quite certain that that's a real phenomenon. That's just part of the bizarre world we live in that just, you know, I almost laugh when I was in my 20s and 30s. I'm sure you're the exact same thing. Like you grow up thinking, oh, yes, I've got this world figured out. I know how this all operates. And then by the time you turn 30, especially, at least for me, it's like you think, okay, I'm not a kid anymore. So I have to have adult ideas. I'm going to straighten up and fly right. And this is my worldview now. And I think that does happen to a lot of people. Like the worldview solidifies. And the next thing you know, you're in your 70s and you haven't changed your ideas in 40 years. But going through this transformation of having for whatever bizarre reason, I decided to pursue UFOs. And it just completely transformed my notion of reality. And I've been spending the last 25 years or more just trying to piece together a new version of that reality.
A world shattered. And then here you are trying to put it back together again. And I have to tell you, doing one of the most brilliant and effective jobs there is. His book, The Alien Agendas, a Speculative Analysis of Those Visiting Earth. What are their motives? Well, there's few people better equipped than Richard Dolan to explore that fascinating and burning question. RichardDolanMembers.com. Get involved with Richard. It is eminently worth your time and Money, Richard Dolan. Thank you so much for being with us on Dreamland.
What a pleasure, Whitley. Thank you so very much for having me here.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Our theme music is The O of Pleasure by Ray Lynch. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host. And I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander.